This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. It's been a tough year for folks cooped up at home, and those who were lucky enough to work from home, going to virtual meetings became the new normal. While it may have been a little unnerving at first, staring at yourself while trying to pay attention to others, some companies rolled out features to make it a little less awkward. Don't want to put on makeup? Use a filter. Room is messy? Put up a fake background. But how much did that play into people who may not have considered getting some work done now thinking about a little Botox? And on that same note, how much easier was it for people already wanting some bigger procedures to get those done and recover in private at home? With us now to tell us more about the world of plastic surgery is Dr. Lynn Jeffers, past president of the American Society of Plastic Surgeons and chief medical officer at St. John's Pleasant Valley Hospital. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me today.
Dr. Jeffers, a study that recently came out from the American Society of Plastic Surgeons had a headline stating Americans had a more positive attitude toward plastic surgery during COVID-19. Why is that?
Well, it's interesting. There's so many different theories, but we were surprised. When COVID first started, we actually put out a consumer survey just to see what people were thinking. And then we repeated that survey just a few months ago, just to see what happened during this COVID pandemic. And like you said, it showed that people were more interested in cosmetic surgery and cosmetic procedures during that time. We've credited to a number of things, what you just talked about, the Zoom boom, where suddenly you're seeing your face plastered on this big screen that you've never seen it before, that big. And also most of us don't have great lighting and most of us don't have great cameras. So it just really shows how, you know, awful it could be. And so people might have been, you know, pushed for that reason. Also, I think a number of our patients have cited the fact that since they were working from home, they were able to recover and hide behind masks. And so that was another impetus for people to seek it out who might not have, who might have thought about doing it later, or maybe were on the fence about it. Mm-hmm. Our most recent survey though showed that because people weren't eating out or taking trips and spending their money on something else, they actually had gathered some money that they might have been able to use toward cosmetic treatments like Botox or fillers or something else. And mm-hmm. I guess the last thing is we all know about the COVID-19 30, right? Or COVID-19, the weight that we've all gained during this time. And so our newer study does seem to indicate that even though during COVID, a lot of the facial procedures were interesting, there's more and more interest in the body contouring, things like liposuction and tummy tucks, probably because of the COVID-19 that we've all gained.
Mm-hmm. Now, I do want to talk a little bit more about the masks, but I do want to ask, is there anything about the feeling that life is fleeting and that the pandemic highlighted, you know, life is fragile, that gives people a push to do something they thought of but never moved forward with?
You know, I think that's true, not even just for cosmetic procedures, but we know that so many of us faced, you know, seeing people that loved ones getting COVID, some of them dying. We've seen the fact that how important it is to have the personal relationships. And it gave us all a chance to sort of reevaluate how we were living our lives. And our patients are saying, geez, you know, I was on the fence about this, but, you know, life is too short. It's time to take the plunge and do something for myself that I've been thinking about for some time.
And in the study, was there anything that indicated why you were seeing more numbers of folks seeking out procedures?
I think there are a couple. One that I said was that some of them were not spending money on, right, you know, dining out and entertainment and so forth. The other one was that since they had more time, they started to do some more research on some of the things they might have just thought about or heard about or talked about before. We were seeing more people looking at the website, trying to learn more about the different procedures and really giving a really great once over on the different types of procedures out there.
Mm-hmm. We joked a little bit about the Zoom boom at the start of the segment. How much did being on these calls have an impact to people paying more attention to themselves than they already did?
You know, I think that, you know, we've all had that experience where you turn on the Zoom and you're like, my goodness, do I really look like that? And I've been there. And I think that if you may not have been thinking about it as much, or maybe on the fence about it, and you're seeing that on the screen, it did push a number of our patients to at least seek the consultation to see what the options were out there.
Mm-hmm. Well, I noticed Zoom started implementing a feature a few months into the pandemic where you could like put makeup on, you could smooth out your appearance. And I just wonder if that gives you such a different feel, like, for example, if you see yourself in that light, you're like, well, now I could see what I would look like if I had a procedure. Maybe I want to get something done. Is that sort of something that plays into it?
It might. I mean, I love my filters, right? I mean, how many of us, I would not go on Zoom without my filters, but, and then even on my Android phone, you know, as you take those pictures, there's so many different ways to filter. We know about the people who post on Instagram and so forth. And, it does make a difference. We all know. And, it does give you that option to say, gosh, maybe I could benefit from something.
Right. And do you think this rate of folks seeking out treatment will go down once things open up and people go back to normal?
So that's an interesting question. We're not sure. When I was talking about a year ago with our first survey, we weren't quite sure what COVID was going to do. And I think that what the survey shows is that I think our members reported that approximately on average 15% of the year was closed, shut down because of COVID. And yet you'll see that the number of cosmetic procedures and surgeries really didn't went down about proportionately, but some of them actually didn't go down quite as much. The things that did go down, like Botox and fillers, would be something that you would expect because, you know, you're probably going to get that surgery once, whereas you get your Botox and filler every 3 or 4 months. And so once you miss that one time period, you're not going to make that up. So that wasn't surprising. But, you know, I'll be really interested to see if that continues. But I think that it gave people the opportunity to research and do their homework about the different procedures. And maybe it would have helped some people who were on the fence to decide.
Mm-hmm. And sort of on that note, with things being put on hold, elective procedures had to be on hold during the height of the pandemic. How did that impact plastic surgeons? Were they able to build their business back up after things closed down, or is it still pretty tough?
Well, anecdotally, once things started to open up, we saw that our members were telling us that they were seeing more patients than they expected. And people were showing an increased interest. And again, we weren't sure at that time whether that was pent-up demand or really just an increased interest. And our survey seems to indicate that it might actually be increased interest. We'll have to see what happens next year. But most of our members are reporting that they are doing better than they had expected outside of COVID.
Mm-hmm. And what about with masking? We touched upon that briefly. Did that give folks more of this freedom to experiment and not worry about possible side effects? For example, someone who always wanted to get lip fillers now, it's okay. No one will notice my lips are swollen.
That's right. We definitely had patients saying that because, you know, if you do happen to get a little bit of a bruising from Botox or filler, you know, or even your facelift, you know, you're going to be behind a face mask. You're going to be behind a mask, even if you have to go in person. So that was helpful for a lot of our patients.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the same thing about our surgeries, right? If you were at home and you had some drains that you needed to empty, normally you would have to figure out a way to hide that in your clothing. But at home, as you know, you only see this, you know, the part up. So it doesn't really quite matter what's happening down south, whether it's pajamas or leggings or what that is down there.
Mm-hmm. And what kinds of procedures have you seen become more popular? Maybe that you weren't expecting that the pandemic sort of drove up.
Well, our ASPS statistics actually showed that facial procedures were much higher this year than usual. And again, that's why we think it has something to do with the Zoom boom, because usually breast augmentation and liposuction, et cetera, are up there. And so this year, it seems like we had a higher emphasis. The top three were nose reshaping, eyelid surgery, and facelifts, which is not usually the top three. However, like I said, it seems with this consumer survey that we'll probably go back to normal next year, but we'll see.
Mm-hmm. What are the usual top three?
The usual top ones are going to be breast augmentation, liposuction, tummy tuck, sort of that type of thing.
Mm-hmm. And when it comes to social media, do you think that it plays a role in reducing what some folks may think is a stigma associated with getting cosmetic surgery? I feel like I'm noticing more and more people being very open about it and sort of promoting it as an option out there.
I'm a firm believer in transparency and also just having conversations. And as you know, social media can be a plus or a minus. So it's really important to make sure that the information out there is accurate and also sets realistic expectations. As you know, we were just talking about filters. You can filter something to something that's completely unrealistic to achieve from one person to another. And yet sometimes people will get sort of false expectations of what can be accomplished. But I do think that social media has helped to bring cosmetic surgery and cosmetic procedures out into the open so that people can see this is something that you can embark on that is an option for people, not just celebrities, not just the what used to be the wealthy and the elite, but it is within reach for the average regular person. But you just got to do it for the right reasons. You've got to do it for yourself, and you've got to do it for some of my patients talking about empowerment for themselves. Like you were just saying in COVID, you know, where you're sitting here thinking, gosh, I just want the outside of me to match how I feel inside. Or maybe some of my other patients have talked about their whole life living for other people and, you know, taking care of their kids and their family. And now it was something time to do something for themselves. So if you do it for the right reasons, it can be a very empowering experience.
And are you seeing, for example, younger generations driving the trend to get procedures done? Have they helped to change some of these attitudes?
I think the younger generation is much more open to it. I think there was a lot less stigma from their standpoint because it's been a part of their conversations that they can see on social media. And so I think that that conversation is always healthy. Always healthy if you're talking about transparency and talking about getting the right information out there.
Mm-hmm. And as far as the work that you do, what have you seen in the difference from before the pandemic to the pandemic to now moving to the future? Have you had to make any sort of adjustments?
Well, the obvious adjustments are things that deal with patient safety, right? Making sure that we do the right things as far as masking and social distancing, as far as making sure that we do the right cleaning protocols and so forth. But also understanding where COVID fits into this. COVID can affect your wrist during surgery as far as how you clot and your wrist during surgery. And so that's something that's important to talk to your doctor about if you've been exposed to COVID or had COVID. And all of those things do factor in. So in that sense, I think it has affected all of our lives and we've had to rethink how we do things. I guess the last thing I would say, though, COVID definitely brought about telehealth. A lot of us were doing it in some form or fashion, but it really made it maybe leaps and bounds beyond where it would have been had we not gone through this pandemic.
Yeah, and I'm guessing that a lot of people feel more comfortable doing telehealth sometimes when they want just a consultation. Like, I don't want to go in and commit to anything.
Exactly. Well, and honestly, you know, for some of our patients were young moms or you're working. I mean, our office hours aren't always convenient, but now, you know, you can take less time off or maybe still have kids running around in the background. Hopefully not, but, you know, where you can actually have a consultation. So it does increase the access to people to at least get that first consultation. And then it actually, I mean, I was doing this before the pandemic, but when somebody has had surgery and I give all my patients my cell phone number, so they'll call if there's a problem and I'll say, you know, send me a picture. Or in this case now with Zoom, you know, just show it to me. Mm-hmm. And before it was more of an issue that some of the patients might not have Zoom. What are you talking about? Whereas I think almost all of us now at one point or another have used Zoom or something equivalent.
Dr. Lynn Jeffers, past president of the American Society of Plastic Surgeons and chief medical officer at St. John's Pleasant Valley Hospital. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Ransomware is a topic that we've been hearing about more these days, from the Colonial Pipeline to the recent attack on the city of Gary. Large ransoms are often paid by companies trying to get back the access that hackers are holding hostage. In the case of the Colonial Pipeline, the ransom paid was $4.4 million. The CEO telling the Wall Street Journal it was paid because they weren't sure just how bad the cyber attack was and how long it would take to get the pipeline back up and running. Are cyber attacks the new future of crime, and how prepared are companies, organizations, and individuals? Is it even a good idea to pay the ransom? We have a lot to discuss today with Vaughn Welch, Associate Vice President for Information Security at Indiana University. Welcome, Vaughn.
Thank you, Miriam, for having me. Looking forward to the conversation.
Well, let's start with the different scams and ways that criminals use the online world to get money out of unsuspecting individuals. Not necessarily those different types of scams, but there are lots of things. When it comes to ransomware, it seems like it's a world of its own. Can you give us a definition?
Yeah, ransomware is a relatively new type of cybercrime. And, you know, let me explain it using a little bit of an analogy. So if we go back, say, 10 years, most of the cybercrime that we faced was basically financial theft. If I can stretch it, let's take a analogy here where your business and your IT is a car, and you've got, you know, you're driving around, you're some sort of traveling a salesperson, say, and you've got your records in there. Most of the cybercrime was the equivalent of breaking into your car, and looking for things that could be easily sold. Credit card numbers, social security numbers, there's even a illicit market for health records. But they were looking for things that could be turned around and be sold. And what this meant is that primarily the businesses that had to worry about cybercrime were those that held those sorts of valuable financial records where there was a market in, where they could be pawned, essentially, so to speak. Now, ransomware is insidious in the following way. If I can stretch the car analogy a little bit, imagine you've got one of those Denver boots, right? Those yellow things that get locked on the wheel that you have to unlock before you can drive your car away. Now, let me get a little silly for a moment, but let's say that boot is so big, it actually goes all the way around the doors of your cars and keeps you from getting into your car at all. This is essentially what ransomware does. It uses cryptography here instead of a big yellow lock, but it locks up your IT infrastructure so you can't use it. And so then comes the ransom demand, the $4.4 million that Colonial Pipeline paid, and other amounts that we're seeing from cities, from K-12 schools, from hospitals, unfortunately, all sorts of other victims, because you've noticed the change now. It's no longer about can they sell the data they steal from you, but can they ransom your own infrastructure, your own ability to operate back to you? And this has made a huge number of organizations that wouldn't have been victims before because they didn't have anything of value, suddenly they turn into victims. You know, it would have been hard to steal $4.4 million worth of data from a gas pipeline operator. It's hard to imagine what they have value. But can you ransom $4.4 million out of them? We now have the answer on that.
Well, are these types of attacks getting more frequent, or are we just paying attention more to things happening because of the pandemic?
I think, unfortunately, they are getting more frequent because the number of victims has grown. It used to be the companies that held financial information, stuff they could steal, they were used to being the targets of cybercrime. They were used to doing more cybersecurity, more physical world security, and they were better prepared for this. Now, all of a sudden, we're seeing companies, we're seeing K-12 school systems, hospitals, these pipelines. They're just not used to these sorts of criminals coming in, and they're having to adapt to this new reality. They're easier targets right now, and in some ways, it's looking like they may be more lucrative ones.
Do these cyber criminals have specific targets, or do they just go anywhere where they can get into the system somehow and then just see if they can make money off of it?
They want to go after, as the saying goes, you know, you rob a bank because that's where their money is. They're looking for people who can pay a ransom in some ways. So it helps if the organization has some money, but they past that, they've seemed pretty much to go after any and everyone. Unfortunately, one reality of cybercrime is the criminals in this case don't have to be, in fact, probably are not in the United States. They can be anywhere around the globe, which just makes this even harder to prosecute and stop through normal law enforcement mechanisms.
Mm-hmm. Well, when I think of places like the city of Gary, where they had a ransomware attack, I guess I'm just curious, like if somebody overseas or in somewhere, you know, not in the U.S. and they're like, we're going to target this small Indiana town and they're going to pay us a ransom. I mean, I guess I'm wondering, how did they pick Gary out of all places?
Oftentimes the way this works is the people who do the initial cybersecurity breach on Colonial Pipeline or Gary or the other organization are different than the people then who come in with the ransomware. So there often is a market in between, where there are people who may just be going around scanning the internet looking for vulnerable systems. You know, it's the moral equivalent of walking down a street and looking for an open door or an open window. The difference is once they find that vulnerable system, they may break in, they may then establish a beachhead, so to speak, but then they don't go any further. They turn around then on an illicit market and then sell that access to someone in who then comes in and uses it to launch the ransomware attack. So it's actually a couple stages that often happen in these sorts of things. So the ransomware attackers are just using whatever they see to be as the most lucrative credentials that are being sold on these illicit markets.
Right. So it's like a whole underground job market in the criminal world.
you've got someone, you know, making, you know, fraudulent keys to houses, and then someone else buying those keys and using it to break in, you know, to use a physical world analogy.
Well, how do folks get into, or the, I should say these criminals get into the system to cause all the damage in the first place? I mean, I'm sure they can hack into it. I know there's things where if you get an email and you click on it, maybe you're exposing someone to your company's system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there tends to be two primary ways that hackers get in the first place. You mentioned email, Miriam, and that's a very common one. They call it a phishing attack or spear phishing attack, depending upon how sophisticated and targeted it is. They may send an email to you saying, hey, I've got a great pitch for the show. Please open this document and let me know what you think. And by the way, it's really urgent. This is really timely. And of course, that that document may contain a piece of a malware, a Trojan, a Word macro. And if your software isn't up to date on your system, you open that. And sure, it looks like a pitch for, hey, we should do a show on ransomware. But secretly behind the scenes, it's now compromising your system and creating what's called a backdoor of sorts, right? That lets them connect to your system over the internet and have it do whatever they want. So that's one way they do it, the phish. The other way is just taking advantage of weaknesses in your software. You know, no software is perfect. It has bugs. Some of those bugs are such that they will allow somebody over the internet to take control of your computer. Now, hopefully, whoever your software vendor is, Microsoft, Apple, whoever, finds that bug first, and then they do a security update. And that's those always at the wrong time, annoying, like, do you want to update now warnings that you can get and then click on that appear. That's what's happening there is your software vendor has found a bug of some sort and they want to patch your system so that it gets fixed before one of the criminals comes along and then uses that in the same way the backdoor that the phishing installed to take control of your system. So those are two very common ways, and this is why we spend a lot of time teaching people to be wary of emails they get and careful what they open and telling people, please keep your system up to date.
Right. Well, now I'm never going to open any pitch emails.
Oh, I had this great idea I wanted to send you.
So what are the benefits when it comes to ransom and stuff like that? What are the benefits of paying it off? Or and then on the same note, on the flip side, what are the drawbacks of paying off a ransom?
And this is a very tough subject. And you saw some of that in the Colonial Pipeline. I mean, the CEO came out and explained why he felt the company had to pay this, because he really felt this short-term immediate pressure to get gasoline to the East Coast of the United States. On the other hand, if you look at the advice from the FBI's computer security unit, they advise people not to pay the ransom. And it's because, well, the CEO of Colonial Pipeline is looking at the immediate need of the company. They want to get back up and in business and serving their customers and making money as quickly as possible. And usually these ransomware criminals are smart enough to set the ransom at a level where it's going to cost you more in lost business than it will to pay the ransom. So it makes business sense to the CEO. Now, if you step back though on the bigger picture for us as a country or us as a world, well, we just dropped $4.4 million into the hands of these criminals doing ransomware, which they're going to turn around and used to get better
at
doing more ransomware. So in the bigger picture, we've now encouraged them and enabled them to get even better at this particular crime. So on the larger picture, you can see the challenge. So we really need to figure out how we balance, you know, the short-term demands of our situation. I mean, we're all going to be upset if we can't fill our car up with gas, and paying that ransomware is going to start looking really tempting. On the other hand, we're kicking a can down the road and we're making that can bigger and more expensive as we do it.
Right. I worked for a company a few years ago where they had a ransomware attack, but nobody knew. Nobody was talking about it. All I know is one day we had these like Wi-Fi server type things and they're like, only connect to this. The internet was out. You know, we had no access to anything, but I guess they ended up paying the ransom, but they didn't want anybody to know. But, you know, everybody found out eventually. And so I'm just wondering, like, what is the infrastructure problem that, you know, this is so easy for if some malware gets through the system and then everything is downhill because one unsuspecting person clicked on it.
Yeah, the challenge that a lot of organizations have is, have you ever been in the situation you're trying to use your computer to get something done? You need to access some file and you don't have permissions. Mm-hmm. Right. And this is a really common good practice within an organization, often called least privilege. And the idea being that you want people to really don't have any more privileges than they need to get their job done. Because that way, if one of them clicks on one of these pieces of malware, okay, so now, I've lost access to my files, but I haven't disrupted your files. It hasn't spread all over the company server. Now, in practice, that's really hard because people get frustrated. If you and I are collaborating on something, I want access to your files. I maybe need access to the files that we used 2 weeks ago for another project. And so in practice, it's very easy to let those access controls drop because we all want to get our work done and get our work done quickly. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like the moral equivalent. Our offices would all be more secure if we locked all the doors between offices and at the front. But then it's a pain in the butt. You're having to take your keys out all the time to get, you know, to the bathroom and back. And it's, you know, highly secure facility. So there's this tension there between us wanting to get our jobs done and get it done easily and quickly, and then having the security that stops things if something goes wrong.
Right. Well, if you're just joining us, we're talking about ransomware and cyber attacks with Vaughn Welch, Associate Vice President for Information Security at Indiana University. Vaughn, in your experience, are most organizations and companies in the U.S. adequately prepared to keep their data and information secure from attacks?
I hate to say it, but no. The world of cybercrime has changed so much over the past couple decades. I've been working in information technology and information security for about 30 years. And at the start, cyber criminals really weren't very sophisticated. It really was, to date myself, it was like, teenagers in the movie War Games or something like that. They were doing this as a hobby. They were doing it for fun, for kicks. And, the bar in your security wasn't all that high and the consequences weren't all that great. And then what's happened over the past 20 and 30 years is the criminal element. And by the way, we haven't talked much here about, nation states and spying, mm-hmm. economic espionage, but that's a whole nother challenge that's emerged. But just focusing on the criminals, frankly, the criminals have gotten really good. They've gotten really sophisticated. They've gotten organized. If you have a ransomware incident now, one of the things they're going to provide you is technical support to help you pay the ransom, because they recognize they want to get paid in something called Bitcoin and cryptocurrency, which is another part of this. But, you don't just walk down to an ATM and get Bitcoin. You have to buy that in a sophisticated way off the internet. But they'll walk you through that whole process. They've got, essentially 1-800 numbers you can call because they want to help you get paid. And that's how sophisticated they've gotten because, as we can see, the stakes have gotten enough now. They're sophisticated companies. And what this has really meant, what I've seen, is for small to medium organizations, this is a real challenge. Because 10, 20 years ago, if you were running a small business or running a small, K-12 school, you could have someone doing the IT infrastructure. They could come in, they could do it. It was, you didn't have to be a cybersecurity expert. But now, because these people find themselves in the crosshairs of these criminals for things like ransomware, the demands of them to keep the cybersecurity up have become so high. It really, I think, isn't reasonable for most of these people to face it. I mean, you think about the asymmetry here, where we've got criminal groups bringing in millions of dollars going up against somebody who's trying to just, keep a kindergarten school or an elementary school open. That's just not a fair fight. And so we're having to see more consolidation and more security get pulled together and raise its game.
You mentioned earlier how some of these software companies like Microsoft or Apple are continually improving and updating their security. But if criminals keep improving the stuff on their end, is this just going to be the future where we're always trying to be two steps ahead of them?
Absolutely. You know, we're still fighting crime in the physical world, so I don't have much hope that we're going to eliminate crime in the cyber world anytime soon. It will just continue to be an arms race of sort. You know, one interesting detail of the Colonial Pipeline attack is, you know, the group that did the ransomware has apparently disbanded and gone underground, which goes to show if you know, you make a big enough pain out of yourself, you will get some serious law enforcement coming after you and going away. So there's a little bit of just like crime in the real world. If you make a big enough problem, you'll attract too much attention, sort of a thing. So it's an arms race, but they want to keep themselves to the point where they're making a good amount of money, but not doing so much, just like with any parasite, right? You don't want to kill the host.
Well, as we get ready to wrap up here, do you have any, I guess, words of wisdom for folks on keeping secure online?
Yeah, I think the best thing people can do secure online, you know, in the old days, we used to give advice about never writing down passwords. And I think that's really changed. Back when we did that, people didn't have dozens or even hundreds of sites. My encouragement to people is think about the sites that are really important to you, your online banking, other critical things for your business. Get good passwords for those. Use a password manager or write those passwords down. And that's a lot safer today than, you know, reusing passwords or using weak ones. And if you can use what they call two-factor authentication, do it.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Vaughn Welch, Associate Vice President for Information Security at Indiana University. We'll be back after a quick break. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soap. When we look at the challenges we face with things like climate change and the ever-increasing footprint we leave behind, we may not always pay attention to what is happening directly around us. It may sound like this affects glaciers someplace far away, but what about in our own backyard? What do the habits and lifestyles we lead do to the plants and animals around us? Is it hurting our environment the more we encroach on animals and plants? And what are the solutions? We're joined now with Julie Borgman, Executive Director, Redtail Land Conservancy, and Cheryl Myers, Founding Board Member of Redtail Land Conservancy and Founding Director of Heart of the River Coalition, to talk more about this topic. Julie, how important is land conservancy, and what exactly is it?
Well, I think it's critical to the future of, you know, the plants and wildlife, as well as the people who live in our communities in Indiana. So land conservation, Redtail Land Conservancy works in a regional level here in East Central Indiana. And there's a network of regional land trusts working across Indiana and the country also. And then there are organizations that work, you know, on a statewide, nationwide and international level, like the Nature Conservancy. And the bottom line is all of these organizations are all working to try and preserve, protect, and restore the critical places, natural areas, lands that support wildlife and plants so that they exist for future generations.
And Cheryl, what does land conservancy mean to you?
I think conserving, the principle of conservation, has to do with wise use of resources as much as anything else. There's a difference between conserving and preserving. I don't believe that, given this current set of circumstances, we are going to preserve too much of anything, but we can conserve by using wisely. And that just means switching to renewables whenever we can. It means rotating crops instead of just planting the same thing each year. It means if you have garden in the backyard, plant native plants, Indiana plants, plants that animals and our wildlife can actually use, not some ornamental from China. And I'm trying really hard to do that in my own garden, so we can all do a little bit.
And Cheryl, when you talk about these native plants and things, is there anything in particular that stands out for someone who might think about planting something for the first time? That's something easy.
Well, let's say you're a first-time gardener, and maybe you're not at all. But if you're starting out trying to be wildlife friendly in your own yard, you might look at echinacea. We call it coneflower. the bees love it. Birds, hummingbirds will come by if you have sage. That's really easy to grow. And those are both perennials. Most of the time, the perennials will be wildlife friendly. Sorry. And I think it also comes down to not having the perfect green yard. It's okay to have a few dandelions and a few native plants mixed in with the grass. I really, really discourage a use of a broad pesticide, because when you use those, you're going to kill some of the beneficial insects as well as the mosquitoes. I'd rather have a few mosquitoes, but have moths and butterflies than this. You know, we'll be seeing brood 10 hatch out soon, we hope. And the use of too many chemicals and clear cutting too many woodlands will reduce the total number of wild things that we have to enjoy.
Well, on that note, Julie, every so often we hear stories about animals or plants that are on the decline due to myriad of things, whether it's deforestation, pollution, chemicals. Why should we care about these stories?
Yeah, you know, I can understand for folks that have never seen a species of, say, bird, you know, why is it important that it's declining? And I think what people need to understand is everything in an ecosystem is connected. And when you lose one thing, that ecosystem doesn't function at full capacity. And while a lot of people like to think of sort of their world with us as the center of it, we're just another form of wildlife, and we're really part of the ecosystem. So things that degrade our rivers and waterways, that affects our drinking water. The loss of, you know, forested land, that affects, you know, our air quality. So whether you care about a species of wildlife or not, it's important for folks to understand that we are wildlife. And anything that affects the ecosystem by the loss of a certain type of insect or the loss of a certain type of plant, it affects all of us. So while you may not appreciate it for its inherent beauty or the role it's playing, people need to understand that we are tied to all of these things. And so anything that affects, you know, habitats, in the end affects us. So whether it's air quality, water quality, you know, open space, it's all interconnected. So it's important to care.
That's a really interesting point. I never thought of it that way, that, you know, I guess we're not the other, we're wildlife too. And maybe that's part of the problem, is that we see ourselves as separate and we're just kind of on the outskirts watching things happen.
Exactly. Or watching things happen, or unfortunately, actually usually taking a pretty active role in, in the disruption, overconsumption, conversion of, you know, these habitats to whatever. And, you know, a lot of times it's unknown, you know, it's not necessarily that people are intentionally going out to try and do the wrong thing. In fact, it's rarely that. It's really, a lot of times people just don't realize. And so a lot of what we do is not necessarily just protecting land, but, you know, trying to raise awareness and help people to become more aware of the impact that their actions can have. Because unfortunately, with some of these rare habitats that we talk about, like a wetland, like, you know, an older growth forest, once it's converted, destructed, drained, logged, etc., I mean, it can take hundreds of years to rebuild that, you know, and sometimes it can never be rebuilt because of the special, you know, soil and bacteria and plant communities and you know, everything working together. So that's why we feel so strongly and passionately about what we're doing, because while you can restore and replace certain things, you know, others we can't, and, you know, it might be too late by the time it is restored.
And Cheryl, what does science tell us about what's happening around us? I ask this because I think sometimes folks want some evidence or proof that, you know, deforestation or encroaching on habitats is a bad thing. Like, where's the proof?
I think the proof might come with some scientific studies of the humble fungus, for example. We're learning that a forest is only as healthy as the underground fungus that is helping it absorb nutrients and water. If you clear cut a forest, and the fungus dies away, it's going to be, like Julie just said, very difficult to reestablish that forest with any kind of integrity for a long, long time. Or another example might be when you eliminate a food source for a certain animal, and then the animal's impacted. I think what is the most worrisome sometimes to me is the rate at which we are introducing new species from other parts of the world that have no predators here. Things like the Asian carp, or purple loosestrife, or the gypsy moss, or feral hog, zebra mussels. There are many introduced species that are outbreeding and outcompeting our native species. And that makes the whole ecosystem more fragile.
Well, I do have to ask you, when you're talking about more species being introduced, I personally have noticed a huge influx of geese everywhere. Is that harmful to our environment?
Yes. Well, Julie can speak to this too, but the Canada goose is a native species. It used to migrate more than it does, but back in the 1960s, when Dwight Eisenhower started the construction of the interstate highway system, every time there was an overpass, there had to be soil moved from farmland to create the overpass. And if you'd even fly over the interstates, you'll see all these retention ponds and borrow pits and little ponds everywhere. That has made staying here year-round a lot more attractive for the Canada goose. So we just have so many more geese than we used to, and they're sticking around. At our little local pond here at Shadyside in Anderson, we must have close to 100 baby geese over there this year, this spring so far. Well, you know, if they all stick around, that's going to be a lot of goose poop, if you know what I mean.
Right.
Yeah. And that deteriorates water quality as well.
Right. I mean, I think about that in terms of, for example, Lake Michigan, there's just so many geese all around, and then there's the water quality and you can't swim and all of that. And Julie, I do want to talk about Indiana on a broader scale. How are we doing in terms of conservation?
You know, well, it depends on what measure you're looking at. So actually, our number of forested acres have increased by like 0.6% since 2011. And I do think that conservation organizations, which in the state of Indiana have only been around since the mid to late 60s, you know, you can see the amount of acres that both our DNR, Indiana DNR, and other organizations have managed to permanently protect and preserve. But if you look at other aspects of it, there are some concerning facts. Like, for example, you know, of the entire state of Indiana, only about 3% is owned by either the federal or the state government. So what that means is 97% of the acres in Indiana are in private hands, privately owned. And the age of those landowners is getting older and older and older. And so, you know, the concern there is as people who have lived and worked on that land start to, you know, get older, retire, pass away, a lot of their heirs don't live in Indiana. And so land is changing hands to people who don't have a connection to that land anymore. They live out of state, et cetera. So they're not there, you know, taking care of those forests, removing the bush honeysuckle and the invasives. They're not there making sure that, you know, the land is cared for in the same way. And also, as that land passes hands, it now, say, you know, that farm now belongs to four people, you know, the kids instead of the one set of landowners. So when you're trying to talk to landowners about conservation practices and things like that, you're having to deal with a lot more landowners. But the biggest thing is the aging of our landowners. And as parcels get subdivided, while the acres of forest may be going up, the size of the forest are shrinking. So now more than half of the forested land in Indiana is in like 10 acre parcels. So if you think about it, if you were to fly over the state, you know, it just almost looks like this little postage stamp of woods here, woods there, woods there. But if you think about it, if you were like wildlife, you know, how do you migrate and move between those areas? It's becoming more and more fragmented with farm fields in between these little parcels of woodlands. So there are some really positive things that have happened, you know, especially even just in my lifetime. My goodness, you know, to see a bald eagle was, mm-hmm. you know, unheard of, you know, prior to the 1980s. And now we regularly see them along, you know, the White River, the Mississinewa River, and around. So there definitely have been some winds, people caring and making a difference. But there are other things that kind of concern us when land is held in private, all in private hands. It's all at the whim of the landowner, you know, what happens to that land.
Is there a push at all to attract younger landowners or folks to take up this as I don't know, a career?
Well, definitely, I see great hope in young people in our field, in the environmental fields. There are so many young people who really do care about the future of this planet, and especially here in our state. So I just can't even tell you the amount of hope I get when I speak with, you know, school groups and younger groups. They really get it. With regard to landowners, honestly, that's kind of outside my expertise in terms of, I know that there are in the ag community and things, you know, that people are working to try and get younger folks into farming. Mm-hmm. But I couldn't really speak to that too much.
Well, Cheryl, can you give us an example of something we've lost or on the verge of losing, and what the consequences for people who want maybe like a real life tangible example?
Well, as a young girl, our family had a lake place in Kosciuszko County, which is full of wetlands. There are so many bogs and swamps and marshes and lakes in that county. And as a child, the water was crystal clear. There weren't too many cottages around the edges of around the shoreline. We had a connection between the Barbee Lakes and Little Tippy and Tippecanoe. And it was pristine, really. You could see all kinds of wildlife. As property values around the lake increased, more and more people started building, and they dredged channels away from those lakes and put lots of smaller cottages on those channels, so the people would have access to the lake. At the same time, they were mostly on septic tanks. And gosh, by the 1990s, the water was really sort of turning green with algae. And we had invasive, like the zebra mussel, starting to move in. And I really watched in front of my eyes a deterioration of the water quality of those lakes. In fact, the Indianapolis Star carried quite an interesting article about the effects of Senate Bill 389 that 110 different conservation groups and community groups campaigned against. Indiana's Department of Natural Resources and the Department of Environmental Management both opposed that bill, and that bill repealed protection for wetlands like the ones in Kosciuszko County that I grew up with. So I'd say the most endangered ecosystem right now in this state would be wetlands, mm-hmm. and woodlands. But we've stripped away protection because, once again, the developers and the building industry didn't like the restrictions that were placed on where they could build. So right. We need to raise the public's consciousness with programs like this very one you're doing. And I'm so glad you're doing this.
Well, we did have a past program talking about the wetlands and the repeal and everything. And we're definitely keeping an eye on that and where it is heading. I do want to thank you both for joining us. Julie Borgman, Executive Director, Redtail Land Conservancy, and Cheryl Myers, Founding Board Member of Redtail Land Conservancy and Founding Director of Heart of the River Coalition. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our Managing Editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.